My name is Sarah Kellogg, and I represent Mr. Archibek, the appellant in this case. I would like to reserve a few minutes of my time for rebuttal. I plan to address Issue 1 today, the Rule 5 violation, but I'm happy to answer questions if the court has any on the other issues. I'll start with the undisputed points in this case. All parties and the trial court below agreed that there was a Rule 5 violation. There was unnecessary delay in this case. It was also undisputed, based on the prosecutor's statements to the trial court, that the only reason the defendant was not brought before a judge in Denver when he was arrested was because of the Denver jail policy, that it did not advise people who were arrested on out-of-county warrants. What is disputed is a two-part question: whether the statements and the evidence were obtained during the period of unnecessary delay, and if so, did that unnecessary delay reasonably contribute to their acquisition? The trial court ruled that there was a necessary delay, as I said, but it found that the evidence was acquired before that delay, and therefore it ruled that there was no prejudice. The reason that ruling is wrong is because, as I mentioned, the unnecessary delay was a direct result of the Denver jail's policy. And so that was the reason that Mr. Archibek was not advised the morning of his arrest. So that
counsel, do you have a case saying that a delay of 9 hours and 45 minutes is per se unnecessary?
I don't, Judge. The cases are sort of across the board, you know, talk about the different time periods. But I think,
For the first several hours there's nobody to bring him in front of. It's the middle of the night. So really the delay, I mean, arguably is an hour and 45 minutes, assuming court opens at 8 o'clock.
I think what's important to look at here is not actually the length of time, even though the cases do reference length of time. I think the important point is why there was a delay. So not necessarily the amount of time. If it took 5 hours to book someone in the jail, that would still be a necessary delay because booking procedures are considered necessary delay. But if it took, if the person was arrested and booked in 30 minutes and then they were just sitting there for an hour, say, because the officer wanted to interrogate them and was doing that knowing that they should be brought before court, then an hour might be unnecessary delay. So I think it's more the reason for the delay to determine whether or not it's part of the unnecessary delay rather than the specific length of time, even though I agree the cases do talk about it in terms of length of time. But here, the prosecutor told the trial court that the reason why Mr. Archibek, the only reason why he was not brought before court was because of Denver County Jail's policy. And that policy directly violates CRIMP 5. And therefore, that's an unnecessary delay. So the statements and the evidence were taken during the period of unnecessary delay in this case. I would point the court to the hearing on May 19th, 2009 in this case at page 6. The prosecutor was explaining to the court why there was a delay in this case and what happened and said, that they had spoken with a sergeant at the Denver City Jail. He is one of the sergeants in charge of the booking process. He indicated to me that they do not provide advisements to any out-of-county fugitive in the Denver City Jail. They simply hold them until the appropriate county with the warrant comes and picks them up, which is why the defendant did not receive an advisement on the morning of the 30th of April, because they simply do not go through that process at the Denver City Jail.
What's the problem with that policy?
That policy directly violates Rule 5. Rule 5 requires an advisement without unnecessary delay before the nearest available court. That language is in Rule 5. And then subsection 3 says, has an entire procedure for when you're arrested on an out-of-county warrant. So the court rules that we have in place in Colorado provide for what happens when you're arrested on an out-of-county warrant, and it still requires you be brought before the nearest available court. So obviously, in this case, I think there's no dispute that Denver would have been the nearest available court. The policy to not bring someone before that court is just in direct contravention of the rule. So because that was the reason, according to the prosecutor's assertion on the record, because that was the reason that Mr. Archibek was not brought before a judge in Denver, that is unnecessary delay. It can't be necessary delay when you have a policy that violates the rule.
Well, I suspect that the next topic is going to be prejudice.
Right.
And I guess I would sort of echo my colleague's question with regard to the shortness of the delay. How do you demonstrate prejudice in this instance?
Well, I think you know, it's important to remember that the prejudice standard that we have is whether that unnecessary delay, which again is, you know, unnecessary in my view because of the policy that contravenes the rule, did that reasonably contribute to the acquisition of the statements. And so if it did reasonably contribute, and that's not a, you know, it had to have created the, it had to have been the cause of the statements. It didn't have to, the evidence that we're seeking to suppress didn't have to come only because of the delay. But the question is softer than that. It's did that unnecessary delay reasonably contribute to the acquisition? I think the prejudice is evident in this case because of Denver's improper policy that created the opportunity and the time for the detective to drive down to Denver and interrogate Mr. Archibek. It's interesting to me, and you know, I don't think there's anything in the record that I can argue sort of bad faith on the police officer's part, and I'm not intending to do that here, but the facts are interesting because they show that the following day, the day after the interrogation took place, I believe Weld County was called at 10:30 in the morning, and Weld County Jail was contacted at 10:30 in the morning, and Mr. Archibek was in Weld County Jail by 1:15 that afternoon. So it's not like it would take very long, or it didn't take very long, to bring him up to Weld County. The detective, the prior day, the day of Mr. Archibek's arrest, was contacted, he stated, maybe around 8 or 9 a.m. And he drove down, instead of, I guess, presumably he could have contacted the jail and had Mr. Archibek brought up or something, but instead of doing that, he drove down to Denver and interrogated him at 11:45 a.m. So the unnecessary delay, the Denver policy in place at this point, reasonably contributed to the acquisition of the statements and evidence because it provided that opportunity for the detective to come down.
But it would have existed whether the detective came down or not. I mean, I'm looking at the statement by the division, and I know you disagree with this case, but the division in Roybal said you have to show that the delay induced the evidence to be extracted or caused it to be extracted or was used to extract the evidence from him. Why shouldn't we go along with the division's reasoning in that case?
Right. Well, I think that language
that would demonstrate prejudice. So I'm having trouble understanding why your test is a better one.
Right. Well, I think that language is actually incorrect under the Colorado Supreme Court law. In Hines, for example, the 1980 case that establishes the prejudice standard, saying that it has to reasonably contribute. And so Roybal is creating this more direct causal connection. And
well, I think it hinges on what's reasonable connection. I think that Roybal is just saying it's only a reasonable connection if the delay induced or caused the evidence to be taken from him.
Right, and I guess I don't mean to split hairs, but inducing, you know, having the delay induce the statements, you know, is, I think, a little bit different than just simply reasonably contributing to the statements. And I think two other points to answer your question, Judge, are that one, you know, once Mr. Archibek had his first advisement, he had counsel appointed. The first advisement is where the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attaches. So I don't like looking at it sort of ex post what would have happened, you know, but we do know that once he was advised, counsel was appointed. So there, you can sort of speculate that counsel could have been appointed in Denver, or, you know, someone would have been there to represent him who very likely, as a defense lawyer, I would say, would assert the rights to remain silent.
He got Miranda advisement, and he declined counsel. He could have had counsel when he was interrogated, or refused to have been interrogated at all.
Right, and I think Hines addresses that by explicitly stating that Miranda is not a sufficient cover for a CRIMP 5 advisement, a Rule 5 advisement. Otherwise, you would just have Miranda and you wouldn't need the first advisement. But the first advisement, the policy reasons for the first advisement are to prevent abuses in the detention process, but then also to actually have, in the solemnity of court proceedings, have the court advise the defendant of their right to counsel. It's the Sixth Amendment right at that point, because that's what attaches when you have your first advisement. And then at that point, the defendant is also able to implement the right to counsel. And often, like he did in this case, once he had his advisement, a lawyer is there at that point. It's a much different circumstance than when you're sitting in a small interrogation room with a police officer having Miranda advisement and as opposed to being in a formal court proceeding, having that advisement from a judge. And I think that that's why in People v. Hines, they said Miranda advisements are not sufficient to find, to cover a CRIMP 5 advisement.
Or the problem that, the problem that I'm having with your argument is it basically reads the prejudice requirement out of the rule. Essentially, you, your rule would say, as soon as court starts at 8 o'clock, if you don't bring him there, you can't question the defendant.
Well, I think we don't need to
draw until he's gotten an advisement.
I think that the plain language of the rule actually does require that. So it's not as though this court has to, in the first instance, draw some sort of bright line rule. I mean, that's what the rule says.
But we're bound by the prejudice requirement that in our precedent, right?
Certainly, but it's without a necessary delay before the nearest available court. But the prejudice here is that that opportunity existed essentially because Mr. Archibek was not brought to court in Denver, and you know, because of the Denver policy. And so had he been brought to court and had he had a lawyer and had he invoked all of his rights as he did when he was actually advised, it is very seems likely that the detective would not have obtained those statements. And I think that's sufficient to meet this reasonably contribute standard. You know, it doesn't have to be the direct causal connection. And in Roybal, just to contrast that case, the defendant's argument there was that, well, I wouldn't have given the statements because I physically would have been present in court had you brought me to court. And so the court said, you know, that's not, that's sort of an attenuated connection, okay? So you would have been there, you wouldn't have been here. But that's not the argument that we're making here. We're arguing that had he been brought to court, his rights would have actually been implemented. The Sixth Amendment right to counsel would have attached. And so because none of that happened, the detective was able to essentially take the opportunity that existed based on this improper policy and use that, and the statements were obtained that way. So I think that's, you know, that policy, that unnecessary delay, reasonably contributed in the circumstances of this case to the acquisition of the statements and the evidence here.
Also, I want to see how far your argument really goes. Here the defendant was arrested at 2 o'clock in the morning. If the detective had questioned him at 4 o'clock in the morning, would there be any problem?
You know,
5 o'clock? When?
I think there's a case which I cite in my briefs, and I'm blanking on the name right now, that says the police can't use an interrogation to violate the rule. I mean, they can't, the delay, if the delay is a result of interrogation, that's not necessary delay, that's unnecessary delay. So it doesn't totally answer the prejudice prong of it, but it all matters about the reason for the delay, I think, and not the time. So if the detective in that case is interrogating instead of bringing the defendant to court, that's an unnecessary delay. Here,
are you saying then that Denver courts have to make judges available at 4 o'clock in the morning just in case there are arrests in the middle of the night?
Or the police could not interrogate them until the defendant is able to get a court advisement.
Well, what's your law for that says you can't be interrogated until you get a court advisement?
That is a case that I cite in my briefs, and I believe it's People v. Raymer, which says, which finds that delay is unnecessary when it's based on the police officer's decision to interrogate the defendant rather than bringing him before a judge. And that's Raymer, a Colorado Supreme Court case from 1983. And so, I mean, yes, interrogations happen all the time before advisements, but here we have a clear rule in place. I mean, Rule 5 is not sort of a new novel thing. Advisements need to happen. I think, though, again, this court doesn't need to develop a bright line rule. It can just look at the circumstances of this case. And the circumstances of this case were that the delay was based on a policy that contravened the rule. And that's where the unnecessary delay came from, and that resulted in the detective being able to acquire the statements. So I think that establishes prejudice here. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Erin Grundy, registration number 41271, and I represent the people. The defendant's conviction should be affirmed because there is no prejudice that the defendant has suffered as a result of the delay in his advisement. Now, the defendant is correct. There is no dispute that the delay in the actual advisement was unnecessary, We defer to the trial court's findings of fact to this respect. However, as Raymer tells us, the critical analysis is not the delay between the arrest and the advisement, or even the reasons for that delay, but instead whether the defendant suffered prejudice because the exculpatory comments were caused, induced, or in somehow caused by the delay that the defendant suffered. Here.
How would you demonstrate that something that happened, something was induced by the delay?
Harvey, which is cited by the defendant in their brief, is a good example of that. In that case, the defendant was arrested on day one from a Colorado warrant and was actually arrested in Wyoming. He made statements to the police in Wyoming, and then 6 days later, when he had still not been advised, he was transported to Colorado and made different statements to police. He made these on day six, absent an advisement, and at those points, clearly the defendant did not have the ability to have counsel appointed to him at that point. His statements were caused by the delay in his advisement. This case is far more similar to a division of this court's determination in Roybal. There, the defendant was arrested, and his final interview, which was also a polygraph, was conducted 16 hours and 50 minutes after his initial arrest. Here, we have 9 hours and 45 minutes of delay, which, as this court has pointed out, several of those hours occurred in the middle of the night, when we can't reasonably expect a court to be available for advisement. And we also can't reasonably expect our law enforcement to ignore the principles of Miranda to find that that no interrogation can ever occur absent an advisement. That's essentially what they're asking this court to do today. Here, if we look to the defendant's statements, if we look to the circumstances, it's clear that the defendant suffered no prejudice as a result of the delay in the advisement. When he was questioned by Detective Lobato, 9 hours and 45 minutes after his arrest, he was given Miranda warnings. He was given them twice, once in writing and once orally, and he was chose to speak to counsel. His statements in this case occurred...
Speak to the police.
Absolutely. He chose to speak to police. Interestingly, he was certainly aware of his right to counsel, as he had court-appointed counsel representing him on two pending matters at the time of this arrest.
Is that something we should take into consideration in determining whether there was prejudice in this case?
Your Honor,
the fact that he was represented by counsel in other cases?
It may be a factor. It's something that has been addressed tangentially in some of the other cases that have come before this court, as well as before our Supreme Court, in whether the defendant has the ability to communicate with counsel. Certainly, he did not actively communicate with counsel here. However, when he was advised of the Miranda warnings, he certainly could have asked to speak to his court-appointed counsel. He chose not to do so. He chose to speak to law enforcement during the delay, not because of it. And the defendant does not argue, and the record does not reveal, that early contact with a judicial officer would have changed his willingness to speak to law enforcement or to change his statements in any way. There's simply no argument here, and suppression is inappropriate. Similarly, dismissal would be a grossly inappropriate remedy here. Now, the defendant discusses the reasons between the delay. However, in Hines, our Supreme Court discussed that it's not the reasons that we look at. There need not be any bad faith shown by law enforcement. Even the defendant sitting in jail by some paperwork issue could be an issue. Yet what we have to look at is whether the defendant was actually prejudiced by that delay, not the reasons for the delay. We're not here to question whether Denver County's policies are appropriate. We're not here to invalidate their rules. The question is whether this defendant was prejudiced by the delay and whether his statements were induced by that delay. There's simply no argument here. The defendant's statements were voluntarily and knowingly made after Miranda warnings, and they were made only 9 hours and 45 minutes after his arrest. This is consistent with Roybal, and is certainly consistent with our Supreme Court's precedent, that the delay did not cause or induce, nor did it reasonably contribute to the acquisition of the challenged evidence.
Counsel, what about your colleague's argument that had an advisement timely occurred, early in the morning, that at that advisement, counsel would have been appointed, and it's highly unlikely that counsel would have allowed the client to speak with police at that point. I mean, doesn't that show that, in fact, the statements were made because of the delay?
Yeah, now under Roble, that doesn't appear to be the case. Certainly in Roble, had the defendant actually been advised while he was making those statements, he would have been unable to make the statements. Similarly, had he been advised before the 16-hour and 50-minute delay, he likely also would have spoken to counsel, who would have advised him not to speak to law enforcement. Yet that's not what this court's precedent and not what our Supreme Court's precedent has shown necessary to demonstrate prejudice. And importantly, even at the May 6th and May 19th hearings, which addressed this issue, there was no argument that the defendant's state willingness to speak to law enforcement would have been amended. That's one of the things that a division of this court noted in Roybal. It had not been argued, and there was no evidence presented that the defendant's willingness would have been amended had he had an earlier advisement. This case is remarkably similar to Roybal. And
was there an argument like that made in Harvey?
Not in Harvey. In Harvey, it was clear. I don't know that it even got to that point. It's not addressed in the court's opinion.
How were they able to show in Harvey that the delay caused the statements?
The statement itself occurring 6 days later, the court's analysis was that in this case, when you show such a discrepancy between the day one statements and the day six statements, also noting that he was transported from one state to another, was not advised, spoke to law enforcement in that time, and the fact that the defendant's statements actually changed from day one to day six was enough to show prejudice. Now, the timing itself is not always sufficient. Our Supreme Court in Garcia addressed that even a very lengthy delay may not inherently show prejudice. In that case, the defendant was actually in custody for 2 months and was not advised on the pending charges that were at issue in that case. And the court still remanded it for a determination of whether he suffered any prejudice as a result of that delay. Pardon me, whether she suffered any prejudice as a result of that delay. And in this case, there is no prejudice. There is no indication that the defendant's statements would have been different. Accordingly, the defendant cannot show the requisite prejudice needed to justify either suppression or dismissal of the charges here. And unless this court has any further questions, we'll rest on the remaining arguments in our brief.
Thank you, Ms. Grundy. Ms. Kellogg, you have about 48 seconds left.
I think it's difficult when you just look at sort of what the defendant would have done otherwise, but it is true that here, once he had his initial appearance, his first advisement, he did have a lawyer presented, and his rights were invoked, his Sixth Amendment right to counsel attached at that point. But I think it's tricky to sort of go back and look at what would have happened, and so that's why I think this sort of reasonably contributed language is kind of a little bit loose. But based on the facts in this case, what we do know is that because of a policy, Mr. Archibek was not brought before a judge in the morning in Denver. And regardless of whether Denver has to do that or should do that or anything, it sounds as though from the record they would have done that but for this policy.
But if we're going to look at the reason, assuming it's okay to look at the reason, don't we have to look at the reason for the policy? I mean, is there any indication that the policy is there to allow this kind of thing to occur?
To the extent that this court looks at the policy, which I think it has to do to determine whether or not this delay is unnecessary, I think, you know, just having a policy in contravention of the rule is sufficient regardless of the reasons for the policy. They have to figure out something else that's going to work within the confines of the rule. And so here I think there's prejudice, and I would just ask this court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kellogg. Thank you again, Ms. Grundy. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.